Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Can you imagine being on stage and getting heckled? What would you do? What would you say?
One of the guys is wearing like an REO Speedwagon t-shirt, which I hated that band. I was like, I said, that's a limp band. What are you, REO fan? That's a limp dick band. And they're going to be a limp dick band when they bury you in that limp dick t-shirt. You know, I go right at it.
Would you say something like that?
I know what I'm doing. I'm going after him. I'm going after him in a real sense. The audience is howling. They're howling. Now the guy, he just snaps.
And what if the heckler loses it?
He throws down the cue stick and rushes the stage. Now, first of all, I knew he's not very bright because if he's going to start a bar fight with me, why drop the cue stick? Bring the cue stick with you.
Today on Storyworthy, I'm thrilled to have legendary comedian Rich Scheidner on the show and his story, The Heckler. Stay close. Okay, I think I've said this before, but the hardest part for me about cooking is the shopping. Like, I can't find what I need in the store, and I don't have time to figure it all out. I get frustrated. But now there's HelloFresh. HelloFresh is a meal kit delivery service that partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and butchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible meals every week. Now, recently, I made shrimp and lemon risotto with roasted zucchini and parmesan, and it was fantastic. I mean, both my daughter, Alabama, and I loved it. And by the way, she cannot believe that I'm actually cooking these meals. I tell her to come in the kitchen and watch me. It's happening. And it's really easy, you guys. The recipes all have step-by-step instructions, and my meals come out looking just like the picture. I mean, it's amazing. And right now, you can get 25 pounds off your first box. Visit HelloFresh.co.uk and enter the promo code STORY. HelloFresh.co.uk and enter the promo code STORY. Have fun with it, you guys. Did I ever tell you guys that I'm a lousy cook? Well, guess what? That's changing because now there's HelloFresh. HelloFresh is the meal kit delivery service that makes cooking fun, easy, and super convenient. Each week, HelloFresh creates new delicious recipes with step-by-step instructions designed to take around 30 minutes for everyone from novices to seasoned home cooks short on time. And not only does it save you time on your weekly shop, it helps you discover how easy and delicious cooking can really be. Like, I love cooking with my friends. I mean, it's a nice way to spend time with people and catch up. And right now, you can get 25 pounds off your first box. Visit HelloFresh.co.uk and enter the promo code STORY. HelloFresh.co.uk and enter the promo code STORY. Happy cooking, you guys.
Hi, this is Rich Scheidner, and you are listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. And I am so glad you guys tuned in today, whether you're a longtime fan of the show or a new listener. Welcome to Storyworthy. Now, I hope you guys had a chance to listen to last week's episode with writer Matt Oswalt. You know, Matt was talking about that movie Fat City by John Huston. So I don't know if you had a chance to listen to the episode or to watch that movie Fat City, but you should do both in that order. Listen to the show first. You know what I'm saying? But today, you guys, I'm so excited because I'm here with the one and only comedian Rich Scheidner. Now, you guys, Rich's career is just insane, okay? And I have to tell you, I've been trying to get him on the show for years, and honestly, he's been recommended to me from like 10 different comics. Everybody tells me, you gotta get Rich Scheidner on. And also, he has a book out, so, you know, that's probably part of it. But truly, Rich has a reputation as not only a great comedian, but as a fabulous storyteller. And his book, Kicking Through the Ashes, My Life as a Stand-Up Comic in the 1980s Comedy Explosion, is really an amazing work of art. If you love comedy in any way, if you're any kind of a historian, you have to get this book because it's his own stories. It's very personal, and he goes chapter by chapter explaining all different facets of comedy as well as different personal comedians. Now, today, Rich's story is titled The Heckler, and I don't know about you guys and how many comedy clubs you've been to, but I have been to not dozens, I've been to hundreds, and I have seen comedians just destroy hecklers. And why people heckle,
I'll never understand how they think they're going to get the better of the person with the microphone. Like, how could the person sitting in the dark get the better of the person that's holding the microphone? But obviously it happens. And I've seen Joe Rogan destroy somebody. I've seen Bill Burr destroy people. I've seen Jackie Cation destroy people. I've seen Dice Clay walk everybody out of the room. I mean, he wouldn't stop until everybody left. But there's two incidences that I want to talk about, and I want Rich to comment on both after his story. I'm anxious to hear what he thinks. The first is, well, both stories, interestingly enough, are from the Laugh Factory here in Los Angeles. So I'm not sure what that's all about. But one of the stories was with Daniel Tosh, comedian Daniel Tosh. Now, what transpired is pretty awful, okay? It's pretty awful. If you know Daniel Tosh's comedy, if you watch Tosh.0, which I love that show. If you know who he is, then you know he's crass and he is insulting, and that's just his comedy. He is appealing basically to, like, I think 19 to 22-year-old boys, right? This is just who Daniel is. So let me just tell you what happened. He's on stage and he's doing rape jokes, you know? Funny, right? Rape jokes, haha. Okay, it's not that it's not funny at all, but you know, to Daniel Tosh and the way he is and his act, well, that's funny to him. So here's what happens. A heckler in the audience, a woman, she yells out, "Actually, rape jokes are never funny." And so she yells this out. And then Daniel Tosh just zeroes right in on her. And he says to the audience, he's looking at the woman who's sitting there, you know, and she's, again, why did she speak out at all? I don't know. But he looks at her. Well, she spoke out because she believed in what she said, and maybe she was a rape victim. How do I know? But you know, she spoke out because of her values as a person, as a woman. Maybe she thought, you know, she really needed to say something. And she could have left, but she didn't. So she yells out, "Rape jokes aren't funny." And he says, "Wouldn't it be funny if that girl right there got raped by like five guys right now? Like right now, what if a bunch of guys just raped her?" So he says this, right? And the girl gets up and walks out. Now, she's probably scared to death because there could be people following her. I mean, who knows? This guy on stage with a microphone, he's got some fucking power, you know? So I don't know what to think about this. I mean, I am positive Daniel Tosh does not think rape is okay. I don't think he thinks that. But I think he could have diffused the situation without being, you know, quite as offensive. I mean, what if he had said something like, you know, "Have you been raped or did you rape someone?" I mean, not that he could make sense of it, but to attack like that and to actually like say, you know, "I hope something horrible happens to you." So anyway, after this incident, a lot of comedians came to Daniel Tosh's defense. And so I don't know. I don't know what to think. I'm going to ask Rich about that for sure. And then the other incident to which no one can possibly defend was when Michael Richards was again at the Laugh Factory. And, you know, as I understand it, he was on stage and there were about 20 people upstairs. There's like a loft at the Laugh Factory. It was like a private party or something going on. All those people are up in the loft and they're having drinks and they're having a party up there. They're not really there for the show, or they weren't paying attention. And anyway, you know, Michael Richards, the first thing he said was, "Look at the stupid Mexicans and blacks being loud up there." And then somebody up in the balcony heard him say that. And then the guy up in the balcony, somebody up in the balcony said, "You know, my friend doesn't think you're funny." And then when he said that, that's when Michael Richards lost it and said, you know, "Fuck you, the N-word." And that's actually when it got started. So that wasn't the worst of it. That's when it just got started. And I don't know anybody that could defend Michael Richards. Now, I don't think Michael Richards is a racist. I mean, I don't. But again, you know, if you're a comedian, you have a certain amount of responsibility and power being the one holding that microphone. And you got to be careful, I think, what you have to say. I mean, it's funny. And then all of a sudden it's not funny. And fuck, man, we all paid this money. We all want to be here. And that's not funny. So I don't know. It's a fine line. It's a very fine line. Oh, hey, listen, you guys. You know how some people still don't get podcasts? What's out there, you know, how to listen? Well, you can help change that with one click. Right now, think of somebody you think would enjoy this episode that you're listening to. You got it? All right, now do it. Just hit the share button. It's usually right there on the bottom of your screen. And if your friend doesn't know how to listen, well, then why don't you stand over their shoulder and grab their phone, and then you teach them how to listen. It's not hard. Remind them that it's free. And then tell us what you shared with the hashtag TryPod, TryPod, for Try a Podcast. And thank you guys so much for spreading the word. Okay, you guys, before Rich tells his story, I did want to remind you guys to follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Storyworthy. And why not head over to my website, storyworthypodcast.com, and join my mailing list, because you know you need more emails. You do, because they're from me, so it's different, isn't it? Yeah, exactly. Rich Scheidner is here right now. Rich is a comedian and a writer and an actor, like I said, and his body of work is just phenomenal, okay? Just phenomenal, including being on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson 11 times, plus The Tonight Show with Jay Leno multiple times. He's also appeared on David Letterman over 10 times. I can't even think about how many times I'm positive I saw Rich Scheidner on Letterman and Carson, but like didn't know as much about him, or I was younger, and now he's sitting with me, and I'm very excited. Rich has had many HBO specials, and he's prominently featured in Jordan Brady's movie I Am Comic. Jordan Brady's been on Storyworthy. He is quite a talent. And that movie, I Am Comic, get it on YouTube. It's right there. And man, oh man, it's super entertaining. And right now, like I said, Rich has a new book out called Kicking Through the Ashes, My Life as a Stand-Up Comic in the 1980s Comedy Explosion. And it is full of fantastic stories. The book has received amazing reviews by like Chris Rock, Bill Maher, Bill Burr, really impressive credits. And you can find Rich at richscheidner.com and on Twitter at richscheidner. I'm going to spell it because I'm a giver. RitchSheidner. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for the fabulous Rich Scheidner.
The story I'm going to tell is actually chapter 28 in my book. I have 82 chapters, all bite-sized, small, as you know. And this one, the chapter was entitled Consider This a Slip, which all of my chapters are song lyrics. And this song, I'll just tell everybody in case they didn't know, is from R.E.M.'s Losing My Religion. So this actually took place, the story took place around 1981 in East Lansing, Michigan. East Lansing, Michigan had a club that just opened called Wits End. This is when the comedy clubs were just exploding across the country. You got the one club and they say, go right to this next club, it just opened. So this guy named Joe Dunkel is a comedian, and he opened up this club. And usually when these clubs opened back then, the first comics who would come in would be the West Coast comics, who were all stars of Make Me Laugh. Guys like Gary Shandling and Vic Dunlap and Bruce Baum and Mike Binder. So Make Me Laugh was a huge syndicated show back in the 70s that was very popular in the Midwest. So these guys were instant draws. And then they bring in the New York comics, and I was like one of the first wave that would come in. And so this club was it was a former biker bar, which I didn't know at the time. All these things I found out later. But I knew I came into a new club situation. I had a fabulous new sound system, an elevated stage, which are two important things, and great lighting. So they had the three main things you need for a good comedy show covered. Great lighting, great stage, and the place was packed. It was a Friday night. When I came in the club, I noticed there were a couple pool tables in the back and some video games. Now, again, back then, video games, this was early video games, so it might have been like a Pac-Man, probably, and maybe even old Space Invaders, and I don't know. I didn't notice whether it was a Pong, which is the first one, you know. But they were there, and I noticed that the video games had been turned off, but the guys were still playing pool. Now, this I knew was not tolerable. And the other thing I would always check to see if they had the blender in the bar, because the bar was in the room. So if there's a blender, I say, look, don't make any fruit drinks when I'm on stage. That's all. Just, you know what I mean? Just go with like shots and beer. That's all you are anyway. Come on. You know, no margaritas while I'm up there because the noise would distract. And that's probably so the guys are playing pool and the club owner, the bouncer, somebody told me, said, don't worry, you know, we'll shut down the pool table and you go up. By the time you're up, it'll be shut. But the first two acts are still playing pool. And I could see, you know, I'd been doing it long enough. I'd been on the road, even though it wasn't long. I'd been a headliner since 1980. This was 81. I was very experienced by then and knew. I said, this is, you know, the first two acts, you know, they cost them a couple of jokes while they're playing pool. You know, a guy hits a pool ball with a loud sound and people get distracted momentarily, which. So I get on stage, they're still playing pool, you know, hitting a rack, man, and just loud. And again, these are comedy clubs back then. This was a big room for back then, a couple hundred people. A lot of the rooms were like 125. They were small rooms compared to today. Mm-hmm. which room was theater size. So it's a tight, small room, and the sound carries. And I said, "Hey, look, guys, you know." And also, as this is going on, I'm getting, there's a woman drunk right up front, who's, again, she's not really, she's talking to me. So you have to make that decision when everybody else can't hear whether you want to respond to somebody. She's drunk, I know. Now, again, I knew instinctively, I've been doing it long enough, the worst heckler for a guy back then was a drunk woman. See, as a male, going against a male heckler, you could destroy him. You could just kick him in the balls till they come out of his mouth. And the audience loved it. They loved it. But with a drunk woman, you could only go so far before they'd start having sympathy for the woman. I mean, I don't mean like so far, like coming back hard, because again, to me, one of the rules of comedy is you don't come back harder against them than they come at you. So if they make fun of the fact that I was going bald, I'd look and see how they were dressed and make fun of the way they were dressed or whatever. Or you just go back in an equal way. You don't burn them down. You know, you just kind of, it's a joust. It's a joust. Because I always had a thing with, again, with heckling, that it wasn't always antagonistic. Stand-up comedy is the one art form where heckling's almost accepted or almost part of the show because the audience is so integral to the performance. If there's no laughter, there's no show. They know instinctively they are required for the performance. So that if you're on stage performing, right, they're just testing you to see if you're really there live. To me, it was not always antagonistic. They're just checking to see if I'm there. If I'm like, who qualified you to run this ship? So show them that you have a captain's license. Show them that you're there. You're in the moment and you can respond quickly. Now, even if you respond with a stock joke, you know, which I never liked to do, and I quit doing them as early in my career, but even if you're doing a response with a stock joke, you show them that you can respond and you're a professionally trained comedian. And they would normally just back off. All right, Captain, you got it. I can relax now. But if you really are getting an antagonistic heckler, you know, you go with them. And as you said in your opening, I've got the things working for me. I've got a lot of things working for me. I have the microphone. I'm louder than you are. I have the lights pointing at me. I have the audience's attention more. And most importantly, the audience wants me to win. If I lose, if the heckler beats the comedian, show's over. The heckler's not going to come up and start doing the show unless the heckler happened to be Don Rickles or happens to be a comedian themselves. They're not going to come up and do the show. They've just ruined the show if the comedian loses. So the audience wants you to win. So just keep your cool. That's the other thing. Never lose your cool. Once you lose your temper, you can fake like you're angry. You can fake like you're frustrated. That's funny. But if the audience senses you truly are angry, you've lost. You've lost. All you have to do is hold your cool and come back at them. And the audience is on your side. And most of the hecklers are drunk anyway, and they've got like one heckle they've worked at and prepared at for weeks at a time. They shoot their wad in one heckle and they're done. I've got a barrel full of stock of it. If I run out of my own heckle retorts, I've got, you know, this is what happens when first cousins marry. I mean, there's a million stock lines. So I'm up there and I'm dealing with these guys playing pool, and I got a woman down front who's babbling at me, and I know I really don't want to deal with her because nobody else can really hear her. So that's another factor you have to deal with. So she's kind of like a gnat in my ear, but it's okay. But the guys in the back, they're the real problem with the pool. So I say to him, I go, look, man, you guys, look, shut down the pool. After the show, I'll play you pool for beers, man. All right, let me buy a couple beers right now, shut it down. And they're like, they flip me off, you know, and they keep playing. So now I go after them. And the one guy's like, you know, he goes, fuck you. So my attitude at first is I'm thinking, here's what happened, because I've had this happen before. I was a young white male comic, not bad looking, not good looking, but I'm on stage and you get a lot of female attraction. And I'm thinking, these guys are the kind of guys, they see me as a threat, you know? I'm coming through town. These guys haven't had a local date in years. Now I'm likely to pull out one of the eligible women, right? Okay, so I see that. I can see that because there's a male threat thing happening. Okay, so they proved they are antagonistic, I go after them. One of the guys is wearing like an REO Speedwagon t-shirt, which I hated that band. It was like, I said, that's a limp band. What are you, REO fan? That's a limp dick band. And they're going to be a limp dick band when they bury you in that limp dick t-shirt. You know, I go right at him, right? So I know what I'm doing. I'm going after him. I'm going after him in a real sense. And the audience is howling. They're howling. Now the guy, he just snaps. He throws down the cue stick and rushes the stage. Now, first of all, I knew he's not very bright, because if he's going to start a bar fight with me, why drop the cue stick? Bring the cue stick with you. Beat me with a cue stick. But he rushes the stage. Now, even funnier, as he's coming up, and I realized, as I see him running up, you know, and his buddies are cheering him, he was the designated go-for-the-comic guy, that he's angry. I can see he's really angry. He's not fucking around. You know, he's angry. So he comes up, and he starts climbing up on the stage. And that stage is pretty elevated. It's about a 5-foot stage. It's really nice. He starts climbing. He actually reaches his hand up like I'm going to help him up. So I yank him up, and I'm an ex-wrestler. I wrestled in high school, college, so I just drag him up on stage and immediately wrap him up, you know, and I turn him around to the audience, and I start playing like I'm butt-fucking him. I'm like, squeal like a pig, which is an old Deliverance reference from back then that everybody got, and they're howling. And I bust him up, I'm laughing, but I forget I'm really in a fight, and he tags me with a couple of shots. Now I'm fighting him back, so we're fighting. We're fist-fighting on stage, truly knocked-out fist-fighting. I'm hitting him, he's hitting me. I get the best of him. I hit him a couple more times, and I toss him off to the side of the stage. Now, the bouncers finally come up, and the bouncer grabs him and drags him out and kicks those guys out. Now, the place is going crazy. I mean, you can imagine. They're screaming. It went from comedy show to title fight, bar fight, elevator, on stage. Not a bar fight like where you have to like crowd around and get a good angle, and I can't quite see everything. Right up on the stage. It's a total show. I mean, it was they know instinctively. This was not planned. He's not a shoe. He's not like going to come back tomorrow night and the guy's going to do the fight scene again. He just had a fight. Because I turned to the audience. Now I'm not even thinking. You know, I turned to my hair. You know, I had hair. Then it's all messed up. I got a couple of dings in my face. I'm sure I'm a little bruised up. You know, a little. My shirt was completely torn. I turned to the audience and I start trying to do my act again. That's the insane part. Anyway, so my dad, you know, let's go back to my act. And the audience is sitting like, no. You're a maniac. You're a true maniac. We'll grant you that. But not a funny maniac. Like you're a bar fighting maniac, you know? Okay, so they're like not laughing at all. So I just do the best I can. And this woman's still talking me out front. She's nattering at me. And I limp through the rest of my act. I mean, you know, I'm dragging them along. I force them to get some laughs and all, you know, but they're kind of looking at me one eye like, well, we're going to laugh a little bit just so he doesn't jump in the crowd and start swinging at us. So I finished the show. At one point, you know, I realized that it was not the best show I'd ever had. And I come off and I talk to the owner, Joe Dunkel, and he said, oh, don't worry, man. Don't worry about it. And the next day he calls me and goes, we are sold out for both shows tonight. We are so sold out. People are begging to get in. People are calling me, begging to get in. You know, I go, you know, there's not going to be another fight tonight. Oh, no, but you put the word out, man. You put the word out. We are packed Sunday night. We're already sold out Sunday night. We are completely sold out. That was unbelievable. Terrific. Unbelievable. So I don't really tell this story a lot because over the years, I'm not proud of it. It's not like it's not like when I got told a lot because I lost my cool and it never felt like it looked me. And I'm working with Robert Klein once, who I love Robert Klein, one of my heroes in comedy. And we're backstage telling stories, him and I. And I tell him that story for whatever reason. And he howls and he goes, I did the same thing. I did exactly the same thing. Early in Klein's career, he was working a Brooklyn bowling alley or something like that. And he got in a fist fight with a guy. He got in a fist fight and then turned to try to continue his show, just like I did. And he's the same thing, man. They looked at me like, oh no, you're nuts. That's all. That's all it ended.
That is the most amazing heckling story I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah.
But you didn't have a choice. He was physically going to assault you.
No. I probably could have had a choice. I probably could have danced around a little bit and avoided it. And maybe waited for the bouncer to come do his job. I probably could have, but I got angry. I was like, oh, you really want to fight? Well,
and
come
you
on.
And you pulled him on stage.
Yeah, I did. I set it up.
Did you have the microphone in your hand the whole time?
I can't remember. The mic might have still been in the stand. I really can't remember back then.
Do you
then.
Remember taking the mic out of the stand in
Don't
the beginning?
Don't remember. I usually did, but not all the time when I first started. Sometimes I left it in there because it's a small room. I'm a loud guy. I could work off mic a lot.
Sure.
So I didn't really look as like I had to have the mic with me.
Yeah.
So a lot of times, sometimes I'd leave it right in the stand and just work around it. Sometimes get close to it, then back off and scream. And people would,
all the best comedians do the best microphone work, I find.
Yeah.
For sure. Okay, but in this case, how old do you think he was, by the way? 20, 30?
He's my age. I was 20, so this is 91. So I was like 20. I was like 28 at the time, yeah. Something like that. So I'm 27.
And so when you have him in this, is it a bear hug? I mean, what is the whole?
When I first grab him, I drag him on stage. Right. I just kind of drag him by me. It's in a wrestling move. I drag him by him and just flip him around.
That's a wrestling move?
I got him around the wrist. Yeah, it's a drag, a one-arm drag. And I got him around the waist with one arm, and I'm pushing his head forward or the other head. You know, I mean, I've really got him controlled. And he's a little drunk, so it was. But here's also what I found out later, that these guys, see, he, Joe Dunkel had a lease that the guys who owned the biker bar originally,
yeah,
still had. They had it. If the club didn't work, right? They could get the lease back. They get the club back from him.
Wow.
With all the improvements he made, because it cost him out of pocket.
Sure, sure.
He'd get reimbursed for none of the improvements, the thousands of dollars he put into place, and they get it back, and they could make it a biker bar again.
So you think
they made
it
a bar?
He was
so
one
they,
of their
he,
taught,
he found that these guys were actually sent in to disrupt the show.
Wow.
They were actually sent to disrupt the show, but instead they put the word out in a way that we couldn't possibly put
no,
it out.
No, that is fantastic. Yeah. Now, same as the Laugh Factory getting put on the map for some of those heckling experiences that I mentioned. But in that case, do you think those guys got kicked out for good or?
Yeah.
Not just for the night, but for the future.
He banned them. He banned them. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
So when a comedian gets thrown off, okay, mm-hmm. I mean, I've done some comedy, nothing like you've done. But what I do know about when you're on stage is you either commit to what you're doing or you go off and you address what has occurred. Right. So it sounds like you broke what you were doing. You broke the commitment of the act. You went for him. But then after all that craziness and all that fighting, and you can tell the audience is completely stunned.
Right.
Then you decide, well, I'll just jump back where I was.
I just tried playing with the audience again and working again. Look, I never had... I had commitment and material. Obviously, I worked material.
Yeah,
I did a lot of Tonight shows and everything. I did material.
Sure.
But I loved playing with the audience. As I said, I never looked at it as totally antagonistic. I loved improvising with the audience. I liked that. That was always fun for me. I never shied away from it.
But once the guy got kicked out, it just seems to me that then you might have continued to engage the audience as to what just took place.
They weren't really engaging me. My memory is they were like sitting back in their seats. I mean, you know,
they were in shock.
Once they came down from the screaming thrill of, it's almost like, you ever see the one where the guy, it's a famous one, I can't remember his name now, but he hits a heckler with a guitar.
Yeah.
Ken, I can't remember his last name. Nice guy, but he lost his mind and bashed a heckler with a guitar.
Wow.
Now, when he was threatening to hit the heckler with the guitar, the audience is screaming for him to do it.
Yes.
If you watch the video, they're like, do it. They're howling. He loses his mind and actually believes, like, what they're saying is what they really feel. They're in the comedy moment. They think it's funny that he's threatening the heckler.
Yeah.
Once he hits the heckler, they all go, no.
Yeah, that wasn't.
No,
yeah.
And he turned, and he, now they're in shock. They're stunned, right? So he puts the guitar back on like he's going to continue his act. And he actually says to the audience, well, he asked for it, didn't he? And the whole audience en masse goes, no.
Yeah.
Right? Because
man, you have such a good psychology on the audience,
right,
on the way it's set up.
Right,
you really
right.
know what you're talking about.
Right.
Here's something I liked in that movie, I Am Comic, when Todd Glass was talking about how you set up a room. And he said, I just want to say to the club owner, you know how like when you go to the movie and there's like the screen in the front and it's dark in the back? Just do that.
Yeah.
You know, it's so true. But you're right in that the audience is an integral part of what's going on.
Essential.
And if they're not laughing, then it's not a complete show.
No, it's not a show.
Wow.
No,
that's really astute.
No laughter, no joke.
Okay, so what is your take then on the Daniel Tosh thing?
Okay, first of all, let me say about the rape joke thing. A lot of comics, they want to do the edge now because you have to make a name for yourself. And it's really important that you get your name out there. And so doing material that's on the edge will help do that. And you want to go to where other comics aren't going anywhere. Where's the fresh material? I hear the thing about rape jokes. I think you have to be very careful when you do jokes like that. Racial jokes, if you're a white person. Rape jokes, if you're a guy, especially. To know where the pie is landing. Every joke, somebody gets a pie in the face. So are you making fun of the rapist? Or are you mocking the victim? Are you diminishing the act itself? I've heard comics do rape jokes and where I go, you're diminishing the violence that is involved with rape. You're diminishing it. Mm-hmm. You're not, you shouldn't be doing that joke. Mm-hmm. It's offensive to me. Like I did a rape joke 25 years ago. I said, you know, rape as a violent act has really little to do with sex. If rape was a sexual joke, women would be raping men. And I'm telling you right now, if a woman puts a gun to my head, the last thing she's going to get is an erection.
Yeah, that's very funny.
Okay, it's funny, but I make fun of...
Right.
What? I make fun
you
of
make
the
fun
rapist.
Of the rapist.
The rapist.
Yes.
It's a violent... It's not a sexual... It's the same thing I used to do jokes about when she asked for it, right? It's like, you know, the way she's dressed asked for it. I said it's like a guy... Got beat up. He got mugged and his Rolex stolen. Well, he was walking through a neighborhood with a Rolex. He was asking to get mugged.
Right.
But that became a hacky thing that everybody was doing.
Sure.
So I dropped it. But the thing that that I want to. I didn't hear what Daniel Tosh's rape jokes were, so I can't comment on that.
Right.
But what I can comment on is that if you're doing rape jokes, if you're doing these things, people, comics like to go, we're protected by the First Amendment, which we are. The First Amendment, that's been decided in court. George Carlin's case, Lenny Bruce's cases. We got First Amendment rights. You think the fact that you have First Amendment rights takes away the audience's First Amendment rights? The fact that you want to do a rape joke and you're working the edge like that, you in your mind can't conceive that maybe somebody might have something to say about that. It may, like you said, the woman might have been raped. There might have been someone with personal experience about that. So it sounded to me like she was conversing. So why didn't he converse with her?
That's what I was thinking.
Instead of coming back to try to smash her right off the bat. See, to me, that was an inappropriate response.
Yeah.
And first and foremost, it wasn't funny. I don't see anything funny about saying, wouldn't it be funny if five guys raped her
well,
right here right now?
Well, it was just a shock value.
That was shock, okay, because he wanted to smash her.
And so,
that's
but
all
it's
he's intended
just, just, and even when you watch Daniel's show, Tosh.0, there are many times where I'm audibly watching the show, like audibly, I'll be by myself, and I'll be like, oh, no.
I get it.
It's that kind of moment.
I get it. He works in uncomfortable
right.
moments. He likes that. He engages that. I get it. But again, take responsibility. You know, you can mess up when you work in those areas.
Yeah.
And I think this is one area where you messed up because you're not taking responsibility for the fact that it was a very harsh thing to say that didn't, it wasn't even funny. So I'm not going to defend it. I'm going to defend his right to say it.
Right.
Also going to defend her right to object to it.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to defend both.
She didn't rush the stage and try
no,
to beat him
no,
up.
No, and she was like going, you know, rape's not funny.
Yeah.
So explain to me how it's funny. Now, I didn't hear his jokes. I'm not even sure what his jokes were.
Yeah, I'm not either.
But engage her.
Right. I mean, what happened to that drunk woman in the front of the show that night you're talking about?
She just
about?
Continued nattering the whole time.
Did she ever
Yeah,
respond?
She got loud enough so I'd have to deal with it.
Yeah.
And I did. You know, I deal with it in certain ways. You know, I used to say, hey, look, I don't speak drunkenese.
Right.
I can't understand what you're saying.
I like the idea.
I used to say, it's a hard time talking with you. You got one brain cell treading water in a sea of beer.
Yeah. I like how you say you hit them with an equal amount
right.
of power because right. also you need somewhere to go.
Right.
You know
exactly.
what I mean?
So, exactly.
Like when Tosh, what he did, he just shut it down.
Because
to
me, that's
down.
A sign of insecurity in a performer.
Well,
like,
he was probably
her.
Very young at the time. Oh, he is young. I mean, he's still young.
He's a great performer, a great comic. I'm just saying
sure.
that you can make mistakes too.
Sure.
And the Michael Richards thing was clearly, again, losing your temper. He
yeah.
lost his temper.
Now, that Michael Richards incident, Frasier Smith, the comedian, he yeah. was hosting that night.
Right.
And then, ironically, he was hosting that night when Tosh was on. So I think Frasier Smith
He's
has something
carrier.
To do with
He's
this.
A carrier.
I think maybe so. Hey, listen, I want to mention a couple of comedians that, of course, I love and have. And if you could just give me something about them, I know this is, you know, this
my
is
my impression of them.
Yeah, just sure. something. I know this is really hard to do because
not
this
for me.
Is so broad. Okay, the guy who has been talking about you to me forever is Steve Cooper.
Yes, cool.
Another Jersey guy.
Another Jersey guy.
He's a great guy.
Yeah, he's a great interviewer. He's a terrific host.
I agree.
He's really, really giving and
Cooper
he's a funny
talk.
Guy. Yes, very
yeah.
good.
Cooper talk. He's
yeah.
very, very genuine. I love him.
Yes.
How about Tim Allen?
Well, Tim Allen and I is in the book here. We came up around the same time. And he, you know, I was working a male-female dynamics, comedically.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking a lot about men and women. And I had more of a post-feminist view.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I like to take the pie in the face as a guy.
Yeah.
Where am I wrong as a guy? And at that time, he went completely the other way. He went as a masculinist. He's like defending the men and tired of men being put down. And it made him very popular.
He is a very conservative comic.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah. I
sure.
mean, he still is.
I'm just saying back then, you know, in a time. Yeah.
How about Roseanne Barr?
Well, Roseanne gave me my first writing job.
Wow.
I think she's one of those seminal benchmark female comics.
For sure.
And hilarious. You know, you talk about post-feminism. She was like, I'm a working woman, right? A mother.
Right.
She's doing everything everybody says to do and saying, this is very difficult. I mean, one of her best jokes to me was, if the kids are alive by the time that my husband comes home, I've done my job.
Yeah, that's unbelievable that's her line. Because
yeah.
That's like in the vernacular now to say
now,
that.
Now, sure,
and
sure.
she did it. Yeah,
sure, that was her line.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
that's
she,
pretty fucking cool
She
right there.
Was bold, funny.
Now, were you writing on her show?
Yeah, I wrote on her show.
Because I heard that she was very hard to work for.
Yeah, she was. But also, you know, I had great moments with her. I had
okay.
great moments to work with her. I mean, I knew her personally, and she gave me a job, and I'm forever grateful.
How about Jeff Foxworthy?
Well, I worked with Jeff a lot, and he's a great guy.
He seems really, like a really good guy.
Truly,
like,
genuinely.
I don't think I've ever heard a bad word.
Truly, a genuinely great guy and
good
generous. And I wrote for him. I wrote for his stand-up act, and I wrote for his TV show, too.
No kidding. Yeah. Excellent. Okay. Yeah. Okay, how about Bill Cosby?
Well, you know, there was a guy that when I was growing up, you know, I had Cosby albums when I was a young guy.
Yeah, sure. Oh,
guy, we all did. All the comics in my generation. Right.
I can see albums sitting around my mom's living room.
Right. But it's all destroyed.
I know.
It's all destroyed. I mean, I have comedy albums of his. You know, it's all taken away. It's really amazing how comics, we live in the goodwill of, like we said about Jeff Foxworthy. He truly is a nice guy. I know him.
Yeah.
But if you find out somebody's not a nice guy, as a comic or a nice woman.
Yeah.
They're just bad people.
Yeah.
It diminishes your love of their comedy. Comedy really exists in a lot of goodwill. That's why so many comics do things like, you know, I just perform for the troops. They always say it in their act, which I hate that.
Yeah, of course.
I don't think you should do that unless you can complete the sentence. I just performed for the troops because it was the best paying job I could get that week.
God damn, Rich. Right? I like you so much.
You know what I mean?
Because
all they're
honest.
Doing, they're trying to take the goodwill the troops have and put a little light on that themselves with it. They're trying to get the audience to like them more because they work for the troops, right? They perform for the troops. That's all they're doing. So comics live on goodwill from the audience. The audience has to like us. You have to like somebody. If you don't like somebody, you won't laugh at them.
Right.
So once this all came out, the revelations about Cosby came out, really came out. And we'd heard rumors for years about his philandering, but everybody was philandering. I mean, you know, that judging a male performer,
not,
you know, that's not.
Right, and it's
but
not
this
a crime.
Is beyond that.
Right.
This is beyond that.
Right.
Once these came out, and the very number of women coming forward, it was way too much smoke to not to be fire.
What was Cosby's big hook? What was his talent? Because when
I
think about him, was storytelling, and also the fact that he could be so quiet on stage and just get everybody to him.
I saw him.
He had such a power of like the king on the mountain, and just everybody crawling up to him.
And about 2005, I was backstage. Place someplace in Inland Empire, I forget where, San Bernardino Theater, backstage with Cosby. Now, they set the chairs up in a semicircle around. He sits in the throne seat, right?
Yeah.
So there's 10 of us, 10 people. We don't know each other, just a bunch of people sitting in a semicircle. And for an hour and a half before the show, they said, be there early. Bill likes that for you to be there early. So we're there like an hour and a half before the show. He tells stories for an hour and a half. Now, I know and a lot about Bill Cosby. So I would actually prompt him. He loved it because I was, Bill, talk about when you used to perform in strip joints.
Yeah.
I wanted to hear these stories from him. And he loved it. And he's killing us for just telling stories for an hour and a half. At some point, his stage manager comes backstage, says, Bill, it's time to go on. Literally, he picks up a cigar, walks from us, walks right out to the stage, and did another 2.5 hour show.
Wow.
So he told stories total for 4 hours.
Unbelievable.
So I realized he used up us as a warm-up. We were like sort of his stretching, loosening exercises.
Wow.
He warmed up with us for an hour and a half, and then went out and did 2.5 hours.
What
so
an
he was
amazing,
amazing.
Talent.
And this was not a young man then. This is 2005.
Sure. Right?
So whatever age he was then.
Yeah.
And
that's astounding.
So comics loved him back then. We all loved him because of his legacy.
And his image.
Right, and
then
his
image. And then the fact his son got murdered. He had some horrible things happen in his life.
And we he was so generous to young comics. Always was. Jeff Foxworthy told me a story once. The first time Foxworthy headlined in Las Vegas, you know, has his name up on the marquee.
Yeah.
Jeff Foxworthy at the Hilton, whatever it was. First night, he gets off stage, goes back to his hotel room. There's a phone call. Picks it up. He goes, Bill Cosby goes, got your name up in the big time marquee lights. Not below the shrimp. Not below the jumbo shrimp. Got your name. Jeff Foxworthy.
Wow.
And Bill invited him over. And the next day, they had lunch with Bill Cosby for a couple hours. And Bill's giving him advice how to handle Las Vegas.
Wow.
Bought him lunch.
Took him up to his room. Slipped a few pills in his drink.
But I'm telling you, there's so many comics have stories like this.
Sure.
From back in the day.
Too bad.
How generous
man.
He was to other comics.
Too bad.
But I got to tell you something. I'd read stories about Cosby, and I was going to ask him this, but I didn't. And there's always something that was a little off. And the fact is, I knew Bill Cosby never had a father. Yeah. His father was an alcoholic who left the family early. And he always did an act that was based upon a nuclear family of a father, mother, kids.
Yeah.
He did an act that was, I don't know if he did that because it was more acceptable in a white society. It was like important to the crossover thing to present a family that white people could relate to.
Yeah.
Right. That we had the same
thing.
A dad. He never had a dad.
Right.
So I was always wondering, I always felt there was something a little off that way. And I couldn't quite figure it out.
Interesting.
You know, and I understand just building an act for an act's sake.
Right.
I understand. I don't put him down the fact that he was doing that. But I was always wondering about that.
Well, the fact that he was, you know, he is portending to have this fantasy life. That's what he wants. It seems like that was an elusive dream for him.
Right. Yeah.
And then once you throw in a sexual proclivity the way he did, that's like trying to get a child molester to not get off on children. If that's what they get off on, that's what they get off on. If you only get off with women who are passed out, then that's what you're going to do. It's just sick. Okay, Phyllis Diller.
I love Phyllis Diller. And it's in the book. I was friends with Phyllis.
Oh, no.
She called me up. My third Tonight Show is in the book. I came back from being bounced out after my second one. Anyway, so Phyllis calls me up after my third one. And it's Phyllis Diller. And I think somebody's goofing with me. Ah, it's Phyllis Diller. I go, how'd she get my phone number?
Her voice is so specific.
Yeah, so specific. But I thought somebody's doing an impression. I said, Kevin Pollak is doing a Phyllis Diller impression now, right? And it was Phyllis. And she says, the way you do the male-female thing, she goes, You do that like nobody else. That's unbelievable. You're a great... And we became friends for years.
That's terrific.
And part of the reason this book was written was Phyllis wanted me to write a book of the history of stand-up comedy. And I started researching. I actually sketched out some chapters and everything. Yeah. And it was just looking too much like a textbook, and Phyllis kept encouraging me to do it. And after she died, I said, I'm just going to write a book on one era, the 80s. There was one of the eras I was writing on, and I'll put my stories in, and I'll just do this.
I adore the chapter titles. They're all different song titles.
Yeah.
Chapter 37, Ease Out, Soft and Slow.
Allman Brothers, One Way Out.
There you go. There you go. Chapter 32, What You Pay for Your Inches of Fame.
So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star by the Byrds.
And chapter 27, Please Allow Me to Introduce Myself.
Well, that's an easy one.
That could have been the first one.
Sympathy for the Devil.
Yeah, that should have been the first chapter right there. Please Allow Me to Introduce Myself. You are such a talent. I wanted to mention in I Am Comic, your appearance in I Am Comic is so bold and so brave because you had quit comedy for a period of time and then you got back into it. And literally in the movie I Am Comic, you see the transformation of you saying you're not going to do comedy anymore, and you see your light is out, and then you see you get on stage and you see that light come back in you. And I just am blown away how honest it is. And real quick, that you are calling all these people on the phone, like you're trying to help out Jordan Brady, the director, and you're saying, well, let me just make a few calls, and you're calling Chris Rock, and you're calling all these famous people, and you're putting your phone number on the screen, and saying, give me a call back, and here comes your numbers up on the screen. Well, what are you doing, Rich?
Jordan put that in as a joke, right? He put that in as a joke. And so we got a laugh in the screening. And once it got a laugh, we couldn't take it out.
Wait, was it your real number?
That was a real number. People call me for years. They still call me. When that thing first came out, I got so many calls. And I made friends with some of the people who called. Some of the young comics, I still... Yeah, absolutely.
I think that is wonderful.
All credit to Jordan for getting me to come out and go on stage again. Because if he had come to me and said, I want to do a... I wouldn't have done it. If he had said, I want to do a documentary about you going back on stage again. So I'm not going back on stage. It was only in the midst of doing it that Jordan turned to me one night. We were at the UCB, over in Franklin, in Hollywood. And he turned to me. He just saw this look on my face. I'm watching comic after comic go up. And he said, do you ever get the itch to go back on? You want to go back on? I was like, sometimes I think. But he said, do it. I want you to do it. And so he made it part of it.
And
that was
Jordan's
genius.
And you went down to the Liquids. Wait,
he picked that place because he knew it would be horrible. He picked the, it was like the worst, you know.
The Liquid Zoo, it's called.
Open mic, down on Sepulveda and Van Nuys.
Yeah, but then you came out of the club and you felt good. The confidence was like, okay, I remember what it was.
I think it
really makes that whole film.
Yeah,
I think you surprised Jordan as much as he surprised you. And everything happens for a reason, you know?
That's interesting.
Everything happens for a reason. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Christine. I really appreciate it.
Join us next week on Storyworthy for a story about collecting air checks with 6-time Emmy Award-winning comedy writer Dan O'Shannon.
And I would collect these tapes and I would digitize them once I got to the point where we were digitizing everything. And I'd get the reel-to-reel player out, and I'd put these tapes on, and I would capture these sounds. Some of the tapes were so old that they will actually literally crumple and kill themselves. They will break apart as they're going through the heads. And so I've got it plugged into my computer, and I'm literally capturing the sounds as the tapes destroy themselves.
Don't miss next week's Storyworthy with the one and only Dan O'Shannon.
All right, you guys, I got to wrap it up right about now. I want to thank everybody over at Wondery Media, including Hernan Lopez and Jeffrey Glazer. And one more time for our storyteller today, Rich Scheidner. You can find him over on Twitter at Rich Scheidner and at his website, richscheidner.com. And go buy his book, Kicking Through the Ashes, My Life as a Stand-Up in the 1980s Comedy Boom. It is so comprehensive. So don't tell me you know about comedy unless you've read this book. I'm telling you, you need to buy this book. And especially a big thanks to you guys, my story-worthy audience, because really, without you guys, I wouldn't have a show at all. So thank you so much. If you get a chance, head over to iTunes. I always need a 5-star rating and a good review, so please consider doing that. All right, you guys, one more time on behalf of Rich Scheidner. My name is Christine Blackburn, saying, make it a story-worthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.